This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A new CDC report estimates much higher rates of Lyme disease than we currently treat, and that number is growing not only in Connecticut, but in places that it hasn't been seen as much before, Maine, upstate New York, even south to Virginia. According to the CDC, only about 30,000 of the estimated 300,000 cases are reported every year. Lyme disease is the most commonly reported tick-borne illness in the U.S., causing flu-like symptoms that can progress to more serious illness, and it can last for months. Some say illness from Lyme can linger for years, further confusing the proper diagnosis and treatment. To make it more complicated, Lyme disease isn't the only tick-borne illness that's out there infecting people. So joining us right now to talk about this new CDC report is Dr. Paul Mead. He's chief of epidemiology and surveillance activity with the Bacterial Diseases Branch, the Division of Vector-Borne Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Mead, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
First of all, what does this CDC report say? What does it tell us that's new?
Well, first off, I want to emphasize that these are preliminary numbers, and they are still subject to some change. But in essence, we know that routine surveillance only captures part of the picture of any disease, including Lyme disease. And so what this is an effort to see if we can fill out that picture and figure out how many cases are actually occurring out there in the community that are not captured through routine surveillance.
So when I give these numbers of 300,000 cases in the United States, but only about 30,000 that actually get reported correctly, maybe you can just give us a little bit better idea of how and why this is happening.
Well, underreporting, as we call it, is actually characteristic of all surveillance systems. So it's not just Lyme disease. It happens with Salmonella and many other diseases that are under national surveillance. And the principal reason it happens is really quite simple. Healthcare providers are very busy, and although I think they'd like to report every case, it takes time and resources to do it. And particularly in areas where the disease is common, where providers are seeing cases of Lyme disease day in and day out, they often don't end up reporting these to local or state health officials. And so that's the principal driver behind underreporting. And that occurs, as I say, not just with Lyme disease, but with many different diseases.
So tell us a bit more about this, and maybe we can start with some of where we are finding this and who exactly is contracting Lyme disease, as far as we know.
Well, yeah, and Lyme disease, I think probably as many of your listeners know, being there in Connecticut where it was really first described in the United States, is a fairly focal disease. It's transmitted by black-legged ticks. There are two species that transmit it, but particularly the Ixodes scapularis, the black-legged tick found in Connecticut in the northeastern United States. And the disease is fairly focal in its distribution within the United States, that is, found primarily in the northeastern U.S. and sort of mid-Atlantic region, and then also in the north-central U.S., Minnesota, Wisconsin, are the two hot spots of high transmission for the disease. And in terms of who gets it, well, you know, anybody can get it if they're exposed to ticks. Certainly we see more cases in children and then also in some adults. Males tend to be a little bit more commonly infected than females. But those are the general patterns. I think the main thing to know is that anybody with tick exposure can get the disease and therefore needs to take steps to prevent infection.
Despite the fact that it is fairly focal, it does seem to be expanding slightly in its reach. Maybe you can talk about this and what we may have learned from the fact that we're seeing Lyme in upper New York State and Maine and down in Virginia and places where it hasn't been as common.
What you say is certainly correct. And in fact, viewers, if they go to our webpage, we have some interactive maps that show where cases have been reported over the last 10 years or so. And what that does show is a gradual expansion of disease out from sort of the hot spots that were seen in the 1990s. So moving northward and southward in the northeast, so moving up towards Maine and also down into Northern Virginia, up the Hudson River Valley in New York State. So the disease is sort of gradually expanding in its area of locations.
And it's expanding for what reason? Does it have something to do with the migration patterns of deer or ticks or people?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and it really gets at the broader question of why has Lyme disease emerged in the United States over the last 30 years or so? And, you know, it's a complex disease with a complex ecology, and there are probably complex answers to that question. And part of the issue is thought to be reforestation of the Northeast from early in the 1900s when there was a lot of agriculture throughout Connecticut and the Northeast and relatively few trees and also relatively few deer, in fact, almost no deer. And over time, farms have gone back to forest. Deer populations have rebounded exponentially in some places. And that has potentially driven both the ticks and the disease to become more common. And then added on top of that is you have people moving into areas, these reforested areas, and living there. So you're bringing sort of together deer, forest, ticks, and people in high numbers, and that's probably helping drive the overall emergence of the disease. In terms of spreading outward, I don't know that that's quite as well described, but presumably it's driven by some of those same forces.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Meade from the CDC, and we're talking about a new study about Lyme disease. We're going to be talking about that throughout the course of the program. We'll be taking your calls in just a bit here on Where We Live. One of the things that's been so confounding for people is how difficult it seems to be to diagnose. The things that we've heard over the years are that people, some people have Lyme disease, they don't know it. Many others will test positive and they don't actually have it. Some people, like me, I'll just give you a personal story. I was bitten by a tick and I went into my doctor and she said, you know what, I'm just going to give you the antibiotic right now and we'll just take care of it. And so I didn't know if I ever had Lyme disease, but theoretically I got the problem taken care of right away. Given all this, it seems very difficult for people to know whether or not they have Lyme disease or someone they know might have Lyme disease. Why is this all so complex? Why is this so difficult, Doctor?
Well, unfortunately, there's, I think, a fair amount of misinformation about Lyme disease diagnosis, in particular diagnostic testing. And the truth is that diagnostic testing for Lyme disease is based on serologic testing, that is, detecting antibodies that you produce in response to being infected. And this is a technique used in many different infectious diseases, so it's not not particularly unknown to physicians. One of the features of serologic testing is that it takes some time between when you are infected and when your body has produced enough antibodies to test positive. And because of that, there's a window period, and this is well recognized in many other diseases, that there's a period between when you're first infected and when your test will be positive. And I think most physicians are familiar with this idea of window period, again, because it applies to so many different infectious diseases. But it has led to the perception that the testing really isn't very good. And it is true that when you are first infected, in the first few weeks, and particularly when patients may show up with the first symptoms of Lyme disease, be it a rash at the site of the tick bite or more sort of flu-like symptoms, they may well test negative at that particular time. And that is why it's recommended that physicians who see patients like that and suspect Lyme disease should go ahead and treat them regardless of testing, that it's a clinical diagnosis at that point. Now, for patients who have been ill longer, infected longer, their body has had time to produce antibodies, and in that setting, they should generally test positive for the disease because the test is probably more reliable than I think a lot of people think in a patient who has been infected for a period of time and has arthritis or other complications of Lyme disease.
So then this gets to another part of our later conversation in the program, which is one of the most controversial pieces. People who either believe that they were infected and their symptoms went untreated for some time, or people who maybe didn't have symptoms for some time and then begin to have symptoms later on, there is this suggestion from many that there is some such a thing as chronic Lyme disease that even once treated in some way stays in the body and continues to produce symptoms for months, even years, or decades afterward. What does the CDC say about this idea of what is called commonly chronic Lyme?
Yeah, well, the chronic Lyme, as it's sometimes called, is probably better. It's a bit of a confusing term, and I think, unfortunately, it's used by different people to mean different things. And to be clear, there is evidence that patients who get Lyme disease and get treated for Lyme disease may have persistent symptoms of fatigue and some difficulty sleeping and thinking and muscle aches. And that's properly referred to as post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. So I think most people accept that there is some condition like this. The question is, who has it, who actually has these symptoms because they've been infected previously with Lyme disease, and who has those symptoms for other reasons, and there are many other reasons why a person may feel that way. But for those who have it, the question is this due to a persistent infection, and if so, is it best treated with additional antibiotics, or is it a post-infectious complication? And to explain that a little bit, there are many such post-infectious complications that we see in infectious diseases, situations where essentially the organism is gone, but it has stimulated your body in such a way that bad things happen. And the problem is that it's hard to find evidence of persistent infection in humans who have this condition. But more importantly, perhaps, it's not clear that giving prolonged courses of antibiotics are beneficial to patients who have these symptoms.
Getting back to the spread of Lyme disease, and one of the theories being the fact that we have a more heavily forested area here that perhaps is a better breeding ground for the ticks that carry Lyme disease. Are there other tick-borne diseases that we should be worried about that are similar to Lyme disease or common to these deer ticks?
Yeah, well, the deer tick can transmit several different infectious diseases, including anaplasmosis, which is a rickettsial disease, babesiosis, which is actually a parasitic diseases, sort of a little bit like malaria, as well as some viral pathogens, including Powassan virus. So this one particular tick it can indeed transmit several different pathogens, which I think underscores the importance of trying to reduce exposure to these ticks and do things that you can to prevent yourself from being bitten, which include potentially wearing repellent, avoiding tick-infested areas, trying to make your yard unpleasant for ticks by a variety of techniques that have been looked at there in Connecticut to sort of remove leaf litter and create dry areas where the ticks can't survive. Another technique, which I'm not sure is that well-known, but which has been shown to have potential based on studies, again, done in Connecticut, is showering shortly after being outdoors, with the idea that this helps remove any ticks that might be on your clothing, wash off any ticks that aren't yet attached, and gives you an opportunity to find ticks that are newly attached.
Dr. Paul Mead is with the Bacterial Diseases Branch, the Division of Vector-Borne Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He joined us by phone today. Doctor, thank you so much for your time. I truly appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Coming up, we'll talk to a local physician who'll answer some questions and tell us what we need to know about Lyme disease, how to spot it, how to diagnose it, how to treat it. Later, a Boston Globe reporter talks about the controversy over chronic Lyme disease. If you have calls and questions, 860-275-7266. Again, you can join us, 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive as we talk about Lyme disease here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The number of people with Lyme disease is much higher than we thought, in part because there's a lot of misinformation about how we diagnose it, recognize it, and treat it. Dr. Stephen Luger is a family physician with Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. He's a national expert on Lyme disease. He says it's both underdiagnosed, and overdiagnosed. He's here to tell us why Lyme is so complicated. We want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Dr. Luger, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, John, for having me.
So first of all, we were just listening to Dr. Mead from the CDC. Are you surprised by these numbers that we have so many cases, the CDC believes, of Lyme disease and so few are actually reported correctly?
I'm not too surprised by it. One, doctors' practices have gotten busier and busier with more paperwork, and as a result of that, the taking the time to actually sit down, fill out forms, and report diseases is very, very burdensome. And if you take a look at most diseases, like the estimate for flu cases in the United States, somewhere around 40,000 per year, and we all see way, way, way more flu than we do Lyme disease, and yet that's also underreported. So I think that some of this is just the doctors not having the time or the practitioners not having the time. But also some of it is based on lab testing, and lab testing doesn't make a diagnosis of Lyme disease.
Maybe you can tell our listeners before we get into some of these questions that they'll have, and they'll have a lot of them, how did you come to be an expert in Lyme disease?
Well, I practiced in old Lyme for about 12 years, and as they say in the hair club for men, I'm not just the owner of the hair club, I also had Lyme disease when I was in practice there. And if I was practicing in Africa, I probably would have been involved with malaria. But being an old Lyme, there was a very, very important need to understand and to get involved with what we were seeing down there.
So when you walked into the studio, you handed me a paper. It's a Lyme disease quiz. And I'm wondering if I can go through some of these questions with you. This is really interesting. So the first question is, Lyme disease is very difficult to treat. Given some of the things that I've heard so far, I'll say false. It's not that difficult to treat. What do you say?
I would say you got that one 100% right. Lyme disease, if treated properly, is a bacterial disease, and we have almost no known bacterial diseases that we cannot kill. So yes, it is treatable at all different stages, though the patients can sometimes have residual symptoms.
Okay, so Lyme disease, number two, is very hard to diagnose. I'd say it is hard to diagnose because we've got all these cases supposedly, and only about 10% of them actually are reported correctly.
Well, I think there's a difference between diagnosis and reporting.
Yeah.
The diagnosis of Lyme disease, if a patient has erythema migrans, the rash of early Lyme disease, the evaluation stops there. They get treated with antibiotics. Blood testing is of no value, and they have Lyme disease. So at the rash stage, and about 80% of people who get early Lyme disease will have a rash. It's very, very easily diagnosed.
So let's talk more about this rash, and this is really an important thing. One of the things you said before the show to me is this bullseye rash idea is a misnomer. And then you showed me some pictures of rashes in which there is a Lyme disease diagnosis. Some of them kind of look like a bullseye. Some of them don't. Explain this for folks.
The Lyme disease rash starts at the area of the tick bite, and over a period starting no sooner than 3 to 4 days after the tick bite, but as long as about 30 days, it starts growing in size. If you let it grow really large over a couple of weeks, it will start looking like a bullseye. But early on, it looks like an oval or a circle of redness. And the people wait for the bullseye, they've missed an early chance to treat it. It also has to be about 2 inches in size to be suspicious for Lyme disease. So if somebody comes in with a tick bite and they have a quarter of an inch around that area, that's local irritation and redness from the tick bite. That's not early Lyme disease.
Okay, so once again, if you see this rash and it's more than 2 inches or about 2 inches in size?
Right, 2 inches in size or greater, that's a very, very likely you're dealing with Lyme disease. And if you see something smaller, it doesn't mean it's not Lyme disease. Draw a circle around it with a pen and watch it over the next couple of days. If it gets smaller, it was a local reaction to some kind of a bite. If it starts getting progressively larger, then you should be seen by your provider and treated.
Somebody comes into your office with this rash that seems obvious to you as Lyme disease. What do you do? What do you prescribe for them?
Well, first, I do a history. I find out where they've been. And as long as they've been in Connecticut and it's the middle of summertime, I tell them that they have Lyme disease. As long as they're not having fever or chills or other symptoms, I treat them with antibiotics for 14 to 21 days. And I tell them that if they're not completely better within 10 to 14 days, I'd like to know about it.
We're going to take some of your calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about Lyme disease on the program with Dr. Stephen Luger. I want to just get to one other thing here. You showed me another piece of paper here, the different sizes of ticks, Lyme disease ticks at different stages. Maybe you can just explain the size that we're looking for, because there are different types of ticks. Some ticks would carry Lyme disease. Other ticks would not carry Lyme disease.
Correct. The size of the tick that's biting this time of year, the Lyme tick called Ixodes scapularis, is a tick about the size of a poppy seed. And if you try to imagine a poppy seed buried somewhere behind the knee or in your groin area or under your arm, most people don't see them. In approximately mid-September, the poppy seed-sized nymph stage molts and goes dormant, and the adults start emerging. And the adults, before they've fed, are about the size of a sesame seed. After they've fed, they become the size of a sunflower seed. So for those of you who like seeds on your bagels, we got poppy seeds, we got sesame seeds, and we have sunflower seeds.
I'm not as appetized by a bagel right now, I have to tell you. I'm not as interested in a bagel. Helen tweets at us, can you get Lyme disease more than once, or are you immune after the first infection?
Great question. Yes, we've had several patients that have been in. You generally don't get long-term immunity from an early case of Lyme disease. There's some question that if you've had a later stage Lyme disease infection involving the joints, the brain, or facial paralysis, that those may confer a certain degree of immunity to new Lyme disease infections.
Let's go to the phones. Rosemary's calling from North Granby, Connecticut. Hi, Rosemary. You're on Where We Live.
Hi there. This is really interesting. I'm one of those people who got Lyme disease twice in one summer. And the first time I had the giant red spots, and I had probably five of them on different parts of my body, and they couldn't even really figure out where the tick first bit. But it was a really easy diagnosis, and then they did the titer later, and it came up positive. Then a couple months later, I can't bend my knees, and I can't bend my thumb on my right hand. Go back to the doctor. Once again, I have Lyme, and they said it is a totally different infection, because I just assumed it was, you know, repercussions from the first infection.
Well, Rosemary, let me let the doctor jump in. This is very interesting. Go ahead, doctor.
Right. I'm curious, Rosemary, how they made the diagnosis of Lyme disease the second time around.
They did another titer.
Okay. That's something that I'd like to speak briefly about, because it's a very, very important thing that both physicians and patients don't quite understand. Once you've had Lyme disease, your Lyme titer will be positive for months, years, or lifetime.
Lyme titer, explain what you're talking about.
Lyme titer, people commonly come in and see me and say, I'd like to be tested for Lyme disease. One of the things that I generally shock them with is saying, the bad news is there is no test for Lyme disease. There's a test for antibodies, and antibodies are proteins that the body produces in response to an infection. So if you had measles or were vaccinated for measles when you were a child, Rosemary, and I check your blood for measles antibodies, you know what? You will have measles antibodies. And I wouldn't look at that test and say, Rosemary, you still have measles. It means that you have measles antibodies. So the Lyme antibodies that you had the first time will persist in your body for months, years, or possibly lifetime, depending on the stage of your Lyme disease. And secondly, the reason that you had multiple Lyme rashes is you were what's called disseminated early Lyme disease, which means the Lyme disease was not just in one area where the tick bite was. It had spread through the bloodstream to other areas of your body, and that's likely where it set up housekeeping in the other areas of your skin or possibly in your joints.
So from what you're saying, though, if a doctor tells Rosemary you have a completely separate second Lyme disease infection this summer, you're saying that's not right.
I'm not saying it's not right. I'm saying the blood test will not help you make that diagnosis.
I understand.
But yes, you can get a second Lyme case during the same season.
You can get a second Lyme case.
Yes.
This test wouldn't necessarily confirm that. Rosemary, thank you very much for the great question. Bill is in Durham. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, I just wanted to make one point, and that is my daughter has had Lyme for over 2 years now, along with other co-infections such as ehrlichiosis, babesia, Bartonella, as well as a number of viruses. And as a parent of a young 20-something that was forced to drop out of college because of her her Lyme disease, one of the most frustrating things as a parent is the fact of the lack of resources that exist to treat Lyme. The infectious disease community doesn't subscribe to long-term antibiotic therapies, whereas the Lyme literate community does. And Senator Blumenthal has been very involved with the Lyme issue for a number of years. And until such time as the CDC is willing to update their guidelines for both diagnosis and treatment of Lyme, many patients, such as my daughter, has to seek alternative therapies. And unfortunately, the insurance companies don't pay for it. There's a tremendous amount of money we pay for out-of-pocket expenses.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's very difficult, very, very difficult as a parent, you know, not to be able to get the support from sort of mainstream medicine.
Let me just get a, and thank you, Bill, very much for your phone call. Let me just get a quick response from Stephen Luger about this. He's using a couple terms, including Lyme literate, something we may be talking about later on in the program. But maybe you can just address some of Bill's questions.
Sure. First, the term Lyme literate is a term that I don't like because it implies that the rest of us are Lyme illiterate. And so that's a little bit of a bothersome term. There is no evidence from the literature and studies, and they've done several studies with long-term antibiotic treatment for people who have had Lyme disease and are having symptoms after Lyme disease, that have been conclusively shown that prolonged intravenous ceftriaxone or other antibiotics don't seem to reverse those symptoms. And that's telling us several things. That one, the symptoms are not being caused by ongoing borrelial infection. Second thing is that there is something else that's going on, and unless we understand what that other process is, that giving further antibiotics doesn't solve the problem. It keeps people away from getting a proper diagnosis as to what else may be causing their symptoms. I had a wonderful case of a woman who flew out from somewhere in the Midwest and came to see me with Lyme arthritis, and she said, I heard you were an expert, so I came out to see you. And after spending 2 days with her, I told her that the good news that was that she did not have Lyme disease. There was something else going on. She got very, very angry at me. She stormed out of the office, wrote me a nasty letter about the fact that I was a quack. And I explained to her that the longer she persists in getting further antibiotic treatment, the longer it's going to take her to consider other possibilities. About 3 months later, she wrote me back an apology letter saying that she was diagnosed as having psoriatic arthritis and not Lyme arthritis, and that she sort of opened her eyes and thought out of the box a little bit, even though she had been vested in this diagnosis, and thanked me for sort of telling her something that she didn't want to hear initially.
In my conversation with Dr. Mead that we heard earlier from the CDC, he was suggesting something, and this is my layperson's translation of this, that essentially Lyme disease can damage the body in a number of ways, and the long-term impacts of that are unknown. Some of those long-term impacts are the things that our caller's daughter or your patient may indeed experience years down the road.
That's correct. And we don't understand the consequences of having Lyme disease as to what happens to the immune system afterwards. And we don't know whether people should be on any immunosuppressive medications. But people have tried very, very bizarre things to try to get rid of the Lyme disease. Probably the most bizarre was proposed by Dr. Heimlich, that we all know from the Heimlich maneuver, who suggested that in the days of syphilis, before they had antibiotics, they used to use heat box treatments, where they would put people in a hot box, raise the temperature to 104, 105 degrees to try to kill syphilis. And he said it would be interesting to see what happens if Lyme disease patients got malaria. So sure enough, once the suggestion was out there, a bunch of people marched down to South America, got intentionally infected with malaria, had high spiking fevers for 2 or 3 weeks, and said, oh, they felt much better after their malaria was treated. So people will do pretty strange things because, as the caller had mentioned, it's very difficult living with a chronic condition that you don't have a good understanding about and that nobody seems to be giving you the help that you're looking for.
I just two comments on that. One is Dr. Heimlich probably should have just stuck to the maneuver, it seems. And second, secondly, I guess I'm wondering, though, about do you see, aside from the fact that people may be putting off looking for other causes, is there a downside, do you feel, to the long-term antibiotic treatment that some people propose?
I would say very, very much so. If you take a look, there are far more deaths in the United States now from C. difficile colitis. C. difficile is a bacteria that people will get in their intestines and as a result of unnecessary antibiotic usage. We have a terrible infection out there now called MRSA, which is a staph. And the reason that we're getting so much MRSA is because bacteria becoming resistant to the vast overusage of antibiotics. And so there are a lot of potential side effects. There are now cases of E. coli and Klebsiella, which are urinary tract infections, that we now have no effective antibiotics for. And people are now dying from it. And these are becoming resistant because people are using antibiotics when not needed, whether it's for colds or other viral illnesses or for things like long treatments for Lyme disease.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Luger about Lyme disease here on the program. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Seth is in Preston. Hello, Seth. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning. I have a question pertaining to the origin of Lyme disease. My father was recently diagnosed, and he had the bullseye rash, and he was given the medication to take care of it, and that prompted me to do some research. I read the book The Hot Zone by Michael Crichton back in high school. That was a good one. And it was talking about the Plum Island Laboratory that is now scheduled for demolition, or I'm not exactly sure. But
yes.
They had been doing testing with bacteriophage technology, and I was just curious as to whether or not the doctor knew the origin of Lyme disease.
Thank you, Seth, for the question.
Seth, that's a great question. The history of Lyme disease is very, very interesting. It goes back to Europe in the late 1890s when the rash was first described. And in the early 1900s, they started talking more about Lyme disease in Europe, though obviously they didn't use the term Lyme disease. And it's been in Europe relatively prevalently since the mid-1940s. And they've described the neuropathy, the nerve pain that people get from it. And they really didn't have an understanding of where it came from. They thought it was a mysterious virus. And then it showed up later in the United States. And there was a very interesting cluster of patients on Montauk, the Montauk area of Long Island, where they developed swollen knee joints in the mid-1950s, and they had no idea why the knees were swelling. The doctors had no idea why the knees were swelling. But by trial and error, they found that if the patients got a few shots of penicillin, the knee swelling would go down and stay away. Fast forward to 1982, when Willy Bergdorfer identified the bacteria of Lyme disease and developed the first blood test for it. They then went back and they tested these people who had the arthritis from Montauk knee, and sure enough, what was going on then was Lyme arthritis. And so this was before the Plum Island research stuff. It's not clear whether it was imported animals, deers, or horses that brought it over to the United States, but the appearance in Europe predated the United States arrival. But thanks for the question.
I think it's a great question, Seth. Thank you very much. Sharon is calling from Newington. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on. Doctor, I just have a very specific question. My daughter, who's 32 years old, was diagnosed with Lyme disease 3 years ago, and we have seen many, many doctors. She has been on antibiotics, you name it, she's done it, and we've seen them. Now she's left with several symptoms, very specific rib cage pain, chest pain, that doesn't seem to go away no matter what treatment. And I'm left wondering, who do we see now? It seems like we need one doctor who can look at all of this. You know, should we see a rheumatologist, an immunologist, an infectious disease specialist? What kind of doctor do we go to who can look at the whole picture of what's going on with her and give her some advice on to how to live her life from here on in?
That's a great question, because one of the things that I love about being a family doctor in Lyme disease is there are many, many specialties that have claimed it. And the neurologists see the neurologic problems, and the rheumatologists see the rheumatologic problems, and the dermatologists see the rash problems. But as a primary care doctor, our job is to look at the whole patient to make sure we understand what is going on with them, both from a neurological, a rheumatological, and unfortunately from people who have a chronic disease, also from a psychological standpoint. Most of the specialists will look at the patient, try to make a diagnosis and say, yes, there's no neurological involvement, that's great news. They don't want to see them back afterwards. So there needs to be a quarterback, and the quarterback should be her primary care doctor, who should be able to say, I'd like her to be seen by a rheumatologist, and should be getting the information from all the specialists, be able to put it together and make a coherent picture for what's going on with your daughter.
So, given that, do you believe that most family physicians understand at the level they should this full range of symptoms, of diagnoses, of treatments? Do they get Lyme disease in the way that you and some others do, so that she would take her daughter to someone and they'd actually get a good result?
I can only speak for myself. It's very hard to judge what other physicians are doing. Some are doing an awesome job with it, and some, because they have busy practices, don't have the time to spend in learning more about something that's endemic in this area over here.
Well, I guess my larger question is not necessarily to pass judgment on your colleagues, but is it taught? I mean, is there a way for you to learn more about Lyme disease, or is there not the literature out there that you might find for some other conditions?
The literature is definitely out there,
yeah.
And the reason I learned about it is because I was in Connecticut. I would hope that other physicians would take the time. Unfortunately, we sometimes see patients who come in and they bring in 30 or 40 pages that they've downloaded from the internet, some from reputable sites and some from non-reputable sites. And the doctors sometimes feel overwhelmed, and they feel like the patient knows more about it than they do. And rather than sticking to the science, the patient says, I know I have Lyme disease. I know I need more antibiotics. The doctors will give that to them. So I would like to see more importance placed in the continuing education for physicians in the Lyme disease area.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Luger, an expert on Lyme disease from Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. Coming up, we'll bring in a reporter who's done a series of articles on Lyme disease for the Boston Globe, and we'll take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, Sean Spellman from the band Quiet Life is heading out on a national tour with the Head and the Heart. But for now, he's spending time at his old stomping grounds in Connecticut. He grew up in New London. He'll be playing some songs and talking with us in our Studio 3. That's tomorrow's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about Lyme disease, and we're joined in studio by Dr. Stephen Luger, who is a family physician with Hartford Healthcare Medical Group, a national expert on Lyme disease, who was around practicing in Lyme when the entire idea first started. We're also joined right now on the phone by Beth Daly, who's an environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. She's going to take us through some of the controversies surrounding Lyme disease, some of which, Beth, we've already waded into on the program so far. So thanks for joining us here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here's what I'll do, Beth. I'm just going to put a tweet from Bill right to you. I just called in, and he says, your guest represents one side of the controversy. I suggest you invite a Lyme-literate doctor on your program. We've already heard some calls and some tweets like Bill's. This is, I assume, Beth, a lot of what you're hearing when it comes down to this controversy.
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides to this incredible controversy, and it's sort of stunning how controversial it is. On one side, obviously, is the medical establishment, which is evidence-based, and they say, look, there's no credible evidence that we've seen yet that says Lyme disease is a persistent chronic infection. They say, yes, up to 25% of people who have Lyme disease remain sick or unwell after they're treated for, you know, maybe for a couple of days, maybe as long as years. But they say that's not an active infection and it should not be treated with long course antibiotics. On the other side, an entire community of patients, of doctors, and a very strong political force have cropped up that says, no, no, you know, we're doctors too, and we're patients, and we believe this is a chronic persistent infection, and we need long course antibiotics to get well. And it's really an experience based for patients. They do feel better on antibiotics, and they say, so that's more or less proof that this Lyme disease is a chronic infection. On the other side, the medical establishment says, no, we have not seen that, and please don't take long course antibiotics.
Are there any areas of agreement between the factions? I mean, this has been going on for some time, Beth. I mean, are people starting to agree on anything?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The way you would read it is that both sides are completely polarized, and there's factions on both sides that are completely and utterly polarized. But honestly, there's a lot of work in the middle. And right now, there's really excellent work being done at Yale, at Tufts, that's basically trying to unlock why some patients who have Lyme, that everyone agrees with Lyme, because diagnostics are a big issue, that everyone agrees with Lyme, remain unwell. And it's very interesting. The science is still out. Nothing is decided. And it could be a variety of factors. It could be there's some work at Yale that is looking at maybe this spirochete, which is a type of bacteria, Lyme disease is, leaves some leftover proteins in your body that causes your body to, immune system to react, and maybe that's why you still have joint inflammation after you've been basically cured of Lyme disease. Others are looking at why in animal models the spirochete is intact. There's actually spirochete left over after mice and some animals are treated with antibiotics. And it's a very interesting question. It appears these spirochetes are not infectious so far, but there's more work to be done on that.
Well, and I'm just going to quickly put that to Dr. Luger here, and I'm wondering if you can maybe pick up on some of what Beth's saying. I mean, what new are you learning? What new research are you looking at in terms of what we know about people's long-term impacts?
Well, a couple of things that I think are very important. I remember in the 1980s being at a talk on Lyme disease, being part of a panel, and one of the state entomologists, Lou Magnarelli, said, if we think that Lyme disease is the only thing we're going to find in the intestines that are transmitted by this tick, we're really wrong. And this was before we knew about Ehrlichia. It was before we knew about Babesia. It was before we knew about Powassan disease. It was long before we knew about this new Borrelia, Borrelia miyamotii. And so there's clearly less understanding of what goes on and trying to understand whether this is really a persistence of Lyme bacteria. And at least the clinical studies I've read are very clear that long-term antibiotics don't seem to stop this syndrome of a post-Lyme illness from going on. And just in your use of terms, Beth, you mentioned the other side, or I don't like that one side is based on science. The other side, you said, is based on belief, where you say, we believe that this is happening. And for people who don't feel well, belief is very, very important.
Right.
But to when I occasionally I lose my cool with patients and they say, well, I think I know I test negative, but I think I have long-term Lyme disease because
right.
I feel better on antibiotics. So I say, well, maybe you have long-term syphilis. That's another spirochete. And nobody wants to have long-term syphilis. They want to have long-term Lyme disease. And there's really no evidence at all that in human beings that they can recover spirochetes. And clearly some patients persist with symptoms. Is this another infection that we don't understand? If you take a look at something called Fifth disease, when an adult gets Fifth disease, they go on, it's a viral illness that gets transmitted, and they go on for 6 months to a year with chronic arthritis from that.
It's extraordinarily painful. I've known people who have it, and it's something that is debilitating.
Right, and it's not from persistence of the virus. It's from some immunologic reaction that goes on. Some of the patients that I've seen with, quote, chronic Lyme disease are people who are suffering from Fifth disease. So it's very important to take a look at the whole picture and to look at what are the other options.
Hey, Beth, you want to jump in quickly before you get to another phone call?
Yeah, I think all that's absolutely true, and the belief system is really important. And it could be another tick-borne disease. It could be something else entirely different. But the fact is that I think a lot of patients have they go to Lyme experts. I mean, I've seen this over and over again, and it's just the way it is. It's not bad or good. They go to a specialist. They see a Lyme specialist who says, "Look, you know, you don't have Lyme disease. I've done all the tests. I have a clinical judgment of years of experience. You don't have Lyme disease." And then the doctor often says, and this is absolutely true, you know, I think you might have anxiety. Your symptoms are really kind of very vague. I can't really pinpoint what you have. Maybe you should go talk to a psychologist, or maybe you're suffering from some sort of something else, and not a medical condition. And the patients feel very shunted off into a world that they feel they don't belong, which is sort of the psychiatric world. And I think that's part of the problem. Mm. The problem is sort of broader than just saying Lyme, tick-borne, or something else. It's really how we deal with patients who present symptoms that we don't fully understand.
Let's go to Mark in East Berlin. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Dr. Lieber, I had been out of Connecticut for the winter, and I came back in early June. Must have been doing some yard work, and I had a severe flu. It's a flu like I've never had before. And I just assumed it was, you know, the late season flu. But then I developed a rash literally from head to toe. And when I went in to see the internist, he said it's Lyme disease. But they did do a blood test, and it came back. And I remember him describing it as off the charts. It was 5+ or something like that. So he gave me an antibiotic, and he gave me, you know, for 2 months worth because I was traveling for that period of time. And he said, take it for a month, and then extended it for another 2 weeks, and that was the end of it. I haven't taken it since. But I'm curious, what the testing, does that identify the degree of the Lyme disease when he describes it as off the charts? I'm just wondering what that means.
It's a great question, and we're running low on time, so I'll put that to the doctor. Go ahead.
All right. That's a very important question. What he meant by that, I think, is there are two different types of antibodies that are commonly tested for in Lyme disease. And the first one is called an IgM antibody, which is the one that's produced very early on when someone's been infected. And that goes up after about 2 to 3 weeks of infection. It goes up. And by the time someone's been infected for 4 to 6 weeks, it's generally very, very high. And eventually, within 6 to 12 months, that goes away. And sometimes it's very valuable in telling us whether somebody has an early infection with Lyme versus a later stage infection with Lyme.
Leslie's in New Haven. Hi, Leslie. We just have a few seconds left. Go ahead.
Hi. My friend that's from Finland just had some scientists visiting that work on Lyme disease. And she told me that there are two distinct diseases in Finland because it's so prevalent. They have a vaccination, but one of the diseases is what we think of as here, and the other one is quite profound has to do with brain fever, and so this is why they have this vaccination, and that sort of blew me away because I never heard of anything like that. I didn't know there was two distinct, and why are there two distinct there but not two distinct here?
Well, I'm wondering, doctor, do you know anything about this?
There are several different strains of the spirochete, more in Europe than in the United States. There's a Borrelia guerinii, Borrelia afzelius, and some have more neurological presentations, some have more skin or joint presentations. So I'm not sure specifically what they're referring to. And in the United States, we had a Lyme vaccine made by SmithKline-Beecham that was around for several years, but then got pulled off the market.
We have almost no time left, so I want to thank environmental reporter from the Boston Globe, Beth Daly. You can read an awful lot about this controversy around Lyme in her work. And Dr. Lueger, before I let you go, if someone gets bitten by a tick, what do they do?
They first save the tick. Please save the tick. We have patients who flush them down the toilet or put them in the microwave. Save the tick. Bring it into your primary care doctor and talk to them. They may want to prophylax you with a single dose of antibiotics, or they may recommend that you watch the area for the emergence of a Lyme disease rash.
Thank you so much for all your time and expertise. I really appreciate it. Dr. Stephen Lueger is with Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. We'll continue the conversation online at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.